Mark Lowen is a British journalist now based in Rome. He works for BBC News as a correspondent in Southern Europe, and he's the co-presenter of OS for BBC World Service. He was also based in Athens covering the financial crisis in the 2010s. After Athens, he moved to Istanbul, where he stayed for 5 years until 2019, a city he knows well enough to return there and cover the aftermath of Mayor Imamoglu's recent arrest and imprisonment. Less than 100 hours after his arrival, he was deported for being a threat to public order. I am Panagiotis Menegos, and in this episode of Smalltalk, I'm its podcast featuring conversations about a world that is changing faster than we can keep up with. Mark Lowen shares his experience on being the latest victim of brutal press freedom suspension. Hey, Mark, thank you very much for doing this.
Yes, Panagioti, nice to talk to you.
How are you? Are you safe back in Rome with the family?
I'm safe. I'm actually in Lisbon with my family, which is where my daughter lives and where my other half lives. So I'm fine. I'm safe. I was very tired because by the time I went to sleep on Thursday night in London, I hadn't slept for 40 hours. So I've been just kind of catching up on sleep and responding to just an overwhelming wave of messages and emails and, you know, WhatsApp messages of support. It's been quite extraordinary, actually. So no, I'm fine.
Let's take things from the beginning. When did you arrive in Istanbul?
I got to Istanbul on Sunday, the 24th of March. Returning to Istanbul because I was based there as the BBC Turkey correspondent for 5 years between 2014 and 2019. So whenever I go back to Istanbul, it feels to some extent like going home or to one of my homes. And, it was busy. I had a busy first couple of days of reporting on the Monday and Tuesday on these anti-government protests over the jailing of the mayor of Istanbul, Ekrem İmamoğlu. And then on Wednesday, I was in my hotel room shortly after lunch, getting ready to report for the afternoon. And the phone in my hotel room rang. And the receptionist said, Mr. Lowen, we have something important to discuss with you in person. Could you please come down? So I went downstairs and I was met by three plainclothes policemen who asked me to take my passport, and then they put me into their car, tried to stop my colleague from filming me being led out. And I was driven off to Vatan, which is the police headquarters in Istanbul. And the atmosphere was generally okay. The policemen were quite friendly, and some of them were saying, you know, we don't agree with this.
So they didn't mistreat you? You were not beaten or abused physically or verbally?
Not at all. I was not mistreated at all. And you know, the one guy after a few hours was hugging me, saying, you know, we think you're a good man. We want you to be free. I was allowed to have a couple of colleagues present in that first location. I was held there for 7 hours. We had lawyers for the BBC who could come in and talk to me. And then after 7 hours, I was taken to another location and my colleagues were not allowed to come with me. I was taken to it's called the Göç İdaresi, which is the Foreigners Custody Department of the Turkish police, and kept there for about 5 hours. And there the atmosphere hardened a bit. It was getting late into the night. I was not mistreated, and, you know, there was a medical check to ensure that, well, not really a check, but there was a medical member of staff there who asked me if I had any complaints about my treatment, and I said no.
So in this second location, you lost access to a lawyer or your colleagues from the BBC?
Yes, I mean, when I got there, I said, I want to speak to a lawyer, and they said, you can't make any phone calls. And I said, I have the right to speak to a lawyer, and I kicked up a bit of a fuss, and they stood firm, and they were getting sort of a bit more aggressive, and they put me into a individual room of sorts. It was kind of like a prefabricated shipping container, and they just sort of dumped a blue chair in there, and they locked the door and tied the door with a plastic tie. And they were not so pleasant there, I would say. They fingerprinted me. There were some other foreigners who had been picked up, a couple of Syrians, a Haitian guy, an Egyptian guy. It was getting late into the night, and they were not very happy with us being there.
These other guys were journalists, or
no? Just they were. I suppose that they were there illegally. And there, and then at 2:30 in the morning, I was taken to the room of the deputy manager or something of that department, and he presented me with a paper saying I was going to be deported for being, quote, a threat to public order. And when I asked what that meant, they said, we can't elaborate, it's just a decision taken by the Turkish government. And then when I asked whether I would be able to come back to Turkey, they said, oh, we don't know, we're not sure. And then one of them said to me, a senior guy, who was probably from the intelligence service, he called me back and he said, oh, I've got an idea, why don't I film you saying you are leaving Turkey willingly and of your own accord, and then maybe you could come back and I could show my bosses and it would all be fine. And I said, no, thank you very much, because I knew that that would be delivered to the pro-government media and...
It would be used for propaganda purposes.
And then finally, at 2:30 in the morning, I was taken to the foreigner custody department at Istanbul Airport and kept there for about another 5 hours. They sort of put me into a room with a couple of rows of hard plastic seats and said that was where I could sleep. But obviously, I couldn't sleep there. And, you know, there was a policeman coming in brushing his teeth, and there was the call to prayer, and planes were taking off and doors were slamming. And then at 7:30 in the morning, they drove me to the plane on the tarmac. They drove me actually to the plane itself, and after 17 hours in detention, they put me on a plane to London, to a deportation flight at 8 a.m. to London.
So you've changed three locations and four different rooms in a total of 17 hours. What did you feel as the hours went passing by? I mean, were you afraid? Were you worried when you lost touch with the lawyers or your colleagues?
I think because I know Turkey quite well and I speak the language to a certain degree, not particularly brilliantly, but I make myself understood and I understand roughly what people are saying, I felt quite calm, actually. I knew that the BBC was working behind the scenes. All the BBC management were working in overdrive, really. I knew that the British consulate was working and the British embassy to secure my release. It was not like I had been detained in a country that I don't know, didn't know. You know, it wasn't like I was in Russia. It wasn't like I was in Somalia. I was in Turkey, which, for all its problems and the erosion of its democracy, is still a place where institutions function, and there is a police service, which, you know, has a... It is still a NATO member. You know, it is not the Wild West. And so that, plus the fact that I just am quite a relatively calm person, I just kind of stayed quite calm throughout the whole thing. I saw, you know, when they said to me at one point, oh, we're probably going to keep you for 2 or 3 days, that was when I thought, oh, God, I really don't want to stay here for 2 or 3 days. And I was just getting more and more tired, really. I mean, by the end, I was feeling exhausted because I hadn't slept, and just sad by the that, you know, I could see what they were doing. I said to them when they were deporting me or you know, writing the papers for my deportation, I said, you realize we're going to report on this and this is going to become an international incident. And they brushed it off and said, there's not a problem. But it was just kind of pointless because I knew it would become a problem, and it has become a problem to a certain extent. And, you know, there's been a lot of international coverage of my case. It has backfired because, you know, just as protests are breaking out against the clampdown on free speech and freedom of the media, they decide to exacerbate things by going after the BBC. So, you know, I in a sense, it was just kind of a moment of sadness and feeling just, this is just totally insane what they're doing.
Have you ever seen your name besides the phrase, a threat to public order, again?
Never. And, you know, they were not huge fans of me when I lived there, because they, you know, we were determined to report very fairly and freely, and as we always do with the BBC, and we have BBC Turkish language service, which they can't control, and they feel frustrated about that. And but, you know, even though a couple of times when I lived there they delayed the issuance of my yearly press card, I never felt that I was going to be deported. And, yeah, threat to public...
So you've never experienced censorship of or suppression of your work while you were based there in these 5 years?
I mean, they didn't invite me to you know, press conferences and things towards the end, and they, and you know, like the number of government people who we could speak to was quite small by the end because there was such hostility towards the BBC, but there was towards so many other Western media outlets. So, and we were all in it together, you know, we were all kind of clubbing together as the foreign press community of Istanbul, of Turkey. We all loved the country in many ways, but we all were also kind of determined to report on all the good sides and the bad sides. And so, yes, I have to say, I never expected they would go after the BBC in this way.
I wanna stay a little bit. I wanna stretch a little bit this phrase, a threat to public order, and I wanna ask you how you feel about that, and how you feel about that when you characterize as such when you're trying to do your job. I mean, what's your answer to this statement that looks outrageous?
I mean, I remember when I lived there, the word terrorist was bandied around. It was almost like the most kind of commonly used, one of the most commonly used words in public discourse. And I've been, you know, I was labeled a terrorist or terrorist supporter and things by kind of various pro-government people and government people. And so I kind of developed a bit of a thick skin, I would say. You know, I was heavily kind of attacked in the pro-government media. I was on the front pages of pro-government newspapers when I lived there, being called a traitor who should be captured and deported. But, you know, that was a kind of like, even though I say that, and I think, you know, now, well, 5 years later, I was deported. Well, no, 10 years later, I was deported. You know, the newspapers, that we have a phrase in English, the bark is worse than the bite, like for a dog. And, you know, I've always felt that the Turkish media's bark was worse than their bite. And they never actually kind of went after me in that way, you know, physically, until now. So, all of that to say that I have been labelled a number of things in Turkey. Modern-day Lawrence of Arabia, they called me, an agent, a spy, all this kind of thing. But then a threat to public order, I mean, it's just, it's so nonsensical. I mean, I was doing my job. I'm a journalist. I'm a journalist for an organisation that cherishes freedom of the media and impartial reporting, and that's what I believe I was doing. And there is no argument, there is no basis in the argument that I was any threat to public order.
So, but over the past few days, we read daily stories about other foreign journalists arrested. So, in this current circumstance, is press freedom a luxury in Turkey? Is the press, especially the foreign press, considered as an enemy of the state?
I think that that's been the case for years. I remember going to rallies of President Erdogan when I lived there, in which he would call out individual media outlets with his, he would say, hey, The Economist, hey, CNN, hey, Spiegel, hey, BBC. And we were denoted as a threat. We were portrayed as a threat to Turkishness, to the government, that we were part of some kind of international lobby group. That's how we were depicted, along with, you know, various other companies, Lufthansa at one point, interest rate lobby, the Armenians, the Greeks, I'm sure, several, yeah, they do. I mean, they you know, very often targeted the Greeks. So, it's, I mean, even though we all think, well, we have the protection of our, of the fact that we are not Turkish, that, you know, we answer to a newsroom and an editor in London or Paris or New York or wherever we answer to, that's no longer a safety net. And, you know, a government that feels unshackled and determined to stay in power and determined to crack down even more on any semblance of debate or criticism or discussion is willing to stop at nothing.
Are Western institutions doing enough for this? For this suppression of press freedom or human rights? Especially in this current circumstance.
They speak out quite a lot, various governments and various institutions. But there is a sort of balancing act that they try to perform, because Turkey is too important to ignore or enrage. It is it's got the second largest military in NATO. It's a hugely important player when it comes to pretty much every geopolitical conflict at the moment. Ukraine, Syria, migration, Gaza. In a multipolar world, Turkey is one of those poles. And President Erdogan has hugely increased the profile and the authority of the Turkish Republic. And I know from diplomats that they feel frustrated by the state of Turkey, the state of Turkish democracy. But equally, it is a country that you have to engage with, and you can't simply say we're going to sanction Turkey until they release journalists. I mean, there have been, it's not just journalists, it's human rights defenders, it's, you know, if Turkey was going to be sort of sanctioned or shunned for every violation of democratic norms, then kind of the whole of Western Europe would have nothing to do with Turkey at the moment. So they use carrots and sticks, and, you know, EU membership, which nobody expects Turkey to achieve anytime soon, is still dangled as a carrot. You know, progression to the next chapters of negotiations, visa-free travel for Turks was, you know, when I lived there, it was a huge topic of discussion. But because Turkey was using the word terrorism to depict its enemies, one of the conditions was you've got to stop doing that, otherwise we won't give you visa-free travel. They didn't stop it, and so visa-free travel was held up and has not been implemented. So yeah, it's a very difficult relationship with Ankara.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to these couple of days you were able to do your job before the detention. How did this reporting go? I mean, what did you hear from the Turkish people on the streets? I believe someone told you that it's make or break time for Turkey.
Yeah, I remember somebody saying to me, you know, we don't want to be here. We want to be home with our families, but we want democracy. That is all the word used over and over again is democracy, because Turkey is still for all its downsides, if you like, it is still officially a democracy. I would say that, you know, it is a kind of more of a hybrid now between an authoritarian state and a democracy, but, you know, officially it's still a democracy. Those who are out on the streets and they are in there, and they're hundreds of thousands, and far more than that if those who support the protests, they don't feel that their country is a democracy anymore, and they feel that they feel stifled. I met a lot of people, a lot of protesters, and interestingly, I remember speaking, going to outside a university in Istanbul, and there was a sit-in outside where they were boycotting their classes, and they were all pretty much wearing face coverings. And I said to one of them, why are you wearing a face covering? Why are you masking your face? And he said, because they come to our houses at 6 o'clock in the morning without warning, to lead us off to police stations to find us, to see who was protesting, and so we've got to protect ourselves. And then a day later, they sort of did the same to me, not at 6 o'clock in the morning, but so there is, it's always been a country that's kind of got, I mean, it's got lots of different sides, but basically kind of two sides. You've got the sort of religious, more conservative Erdogan supporting side. Not all religious and conservative, but, you know, the Erdogan supporting side. And then you've got the other side, and which tends to be more secular, tends to be more liberal. And the polarization is extreme between them because that is very much Erdogan's tactics. He is divide and rule. He sets one side against the other. And the other side, yes, he has got his base still, but his base has dwindled because of the economic collapse and various other things. But the other side of the country just feels enough, and they just feel it's enough, and they are just determined to stay there now and rise up against him.
So, as someone who knows very well the country, the regime, the fragile balance of democracy in Turkey, what do you think of the next day?
The days ahead, you mean? Well, I have seen a lot of challenges to Erdogan politically, the ballot boxes, protests, the Gezi Park anti-government protests in 2013, which were the largest until this current wave. And I've seen him overcome and crush every challenge and turn things to his advantage, amazingly. And he's a master tactician. But I also know that, first of all, he has parts of his base who are now joining the anti-government protests, you know, religious conservative Turks who also feel that enough is enough. And I also know the determination of the other side of Turkey to keep alive the last vestiges of Turkish democracy and to resist him. That said, he's emboldened internationally at the moment by having Donald Trump in the White House, who doesn't really care about rising authoritarianism in Turkey. As I say, Europe needs Ankara perhaps more than ever, and he feels that he can brush it off. But there's a thing about staying in power for a very long time, which is that you end up kind of in a bit of an echo chamber yourself, and you end up believing that the whole country's with you and that's it. And I don't think that, I think that Erdogan has probably reached that point, you know, where he has his close coterie of advisors and his, you know, the kind of propagandist, basically, who pushed his line out. But that is not the mood overall in the country anymore. I don't think he's got, you know, even though he has brilliantly managed to kind of harness the general political mood over the last 22 years, I think that he is not aware or not willing to accept that the mood has changed now. And he's going to hang on to power for dear life. He's got too much to lose. But he might just have underestimated that changing mood in his country.
You've mentioned it. So as autocracy and authoritarianism are gaining more ground in both sides of the Atlantic, do you think that we should not take for granted that journalists will be safe while simply doing their job?
I absolutely think we can't take that for granted. I mean, you know, look at what's happened in America, the land of the free. The clampdown on the media, on the very best media outlets that in the world, some of them, has been astonishing. It is happening everywhere. It is happening in established democracies. It is happening in countries whose leaders feel emboldened by having allies. And, you know, other strong men allies. You know, it has happened in Greece as well. You know, Greece, an established democracy, has had a lot of problems with freedom of the press especially in the last few years. It has happened in Italy, where I was based after Turkey, where, you know, the current government was accused of turning Italian TV into Tele Meloni, TV Meloni. It has happened in France, where, you know, there's been an increasing control of French media outlets by the Elysee Palace. And, you know, it's absolutely, that is, you know, freedom of the press is something that a lot of us shout about, but I don't think that enough people realize that how in danger it is, I think.
Mm-hmm. Final question. On a personal level, what's the main personal takeaway from this Midnight Express experience?
Well, I mean, we say Midnight Express, but I mean, I had a very easy time
compared
to the hundreds of thousands who have been jailed in recent years, probably millions actually by now, and who, some of whom really have had a terrible time, really have been much closer to Midnight Express than me, you know, have had mistreatment and things. My takeaway is that it hasn't diminished my affection for Turkey. I feel still very close to a country that is beautiful, is fascinating, is crucial, is maddening in almost equal measure. And I want to be able to go back. Not least, I want to be able to take my 2-year-old daughter to see her dad's former home. And so that was one of the things that I was really sad about when I was thinking, you know, in those last hours in detention, I thought, you know, am I going to be able to take my daughter here? But I think that I was probably naive, expecting that the BBC would not be hit. It's very sad to have to admit that an organisation such as the BBC, which I feel is the benchmark of international journalism, is no longer safe in a country such as Turkey, which is, you know, a very, very important close EU ally. And I just think that it was kind of senseless. it's a bit what I was saying earlier, you know, that for what? I mean, when I was in the bus being taken to my plane, by the last police, I was feeling really kind of, I was getting more and more frustrated, more and more tired. And at 7:30 in the morning, or 7:45 in the morning, as I got off my sort of bus from the police, I decided I was going to say one thing to them. I said, "Hepsi bu bir gazeteci için." All of this for one journalist. And this kind of slightly nationalist 26-year-old policeman, kind of his mood changed, and he turned to me and he said, and he walked towards me in a slightly sort of intimidating way, and he said, "Problem var, is there a problem?" And I thought, like, oh God, I don't want to sort of, you know, I don't want to now be denied access to the plane. So I said, I'm just tired. But he said, "And so are we. We're all tired as well." But you know, that was what I felt. I felt like this whole thing that has cost you money in your staff having to sort of watch over me, and cost you reputational damage from all the newspaper articles and TV interviews that, you know, are going to come out of this. Is it really worth it? In my mind, it's not. But, you know, in the kind of mind of the slightly brainwashed, you know, one-sided view of the world, which comes out of following the Turkish pro-government media, they think that this is somehow showing strength and showing determination, that they're going to stand up to this little upstart from the BBC. But it's just very sad that it's happened. And I hope that, I hope I will be able to be back. And I hope that I will go back to enjoy and to report on a really amazing country.
Mark, thank you very much. We stand by your side, and I really hope that you will be able one day to go back to this amazing city with your daughter.
Thank you very much. Christoph Agnoti.
Ευχαριστώ πολύ.
Mixed and sound design by Aris Athanasopoulos. Produced by Panagiotis Menegos. You can listen to more podcasts by visiting podcast.imed.org.